Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Magazine, formerly North Dakota Horizons. For more than 50 years, the bi-monthly publication has been celebrating North Dakota's great people, places, food, events, and history. Subscriptions available at NorthDakotaMagazine.com.
Welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are glad that you have joined us today. Today on Main Street, as we do monthly, we take an opportunity to sit down in a Philosophical Currents segment with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy from the University of North Dakota. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Trust is one of those ideas we rely on every day, but rarely stop to examine. We trust the people closest to us, often, if you're like me, without thinking, but when it comes to institutions, government, media, science, that trust can be a little more fragile, more complicated, and sometimes even more divided. Today on Philosophical Currents, we turn to Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota. Jack is the host of Why? Philosophical discussions about everyday life that can be heard here every second Sunday on Prairie Public at 5 o'clock. That's 5 o'clock Central. And today, though, we're going to explore what trust really is, how it's built, how it's broken, and whether it can be restored in a time when both personal and public trust seem under strain. Jack, welcome back to Main Street.
I'm happy to be here and happy spring. It is coming slowly, but we are grateful for it.
I'll take every moment of it as we build towards summer. Jack, when philosophers talk about trust, what do you mean? Is it a feeling? Is it a decision, a choice, or is it something that's just different?
Well, you've actually kind of answered your own question and the way that I was going to start, because trust is very interesting because it's an emotion, it's an attitude, and it's an action at the same time, right? It is an emotion that we feel in our gut or our chest. We intuitively trust or distrust people. We trust people based on the intimacy of our connections. There's just that internal, instantaneous feeling that is the result of a whole history of things. But then there's this attitude. You can exist in the world in a trusting state. You can presume that things are going to go the way that they're supposed to. You can rely on the fact that the people who have been trusted before, we can still trust. And that attitude that you have really paints an entire picture of how we experience the world. It's not just optimism and pessimism, it's also comfort and vulnerability and sacrifice and all this other stuff. And then there's that action aspect of it, because if trust is just a feeling, it doesn't have any consequences. If we act on it, then we are opening ourselves up to whatever happens in the future. And for many people, making that connection between the feeling and the action is really difficult. How do you will yourself to trust and be vulnerable? How do you move from a state of being untrustworthy or sort of thinking someone is untrustworthy to giving them another chance? So this trifecta of emotion, attitude, and action is a all-encompassing moment. And so trust becomes very powerful, very interesting, and of course, very complicated.
When I go to a restaurant and I make my order to my waiter or to my waitress, I expect that they're going to bring me what I order. Am I trusting them? Is there a difference between trust and expectation in this case?
You are trusting them, And we trust people all of the time. Anytime you are driving, especially in a two-lane road, you trust that the other people are not going to swerve in front of you. You trust that the restaurant has cleanliness, you know, is clean and isn't going to give you food poisoning. And you, of course, trust that the waiter, that the server is going to get your order right, is going to charge you the appropriate amount. And so our everyday existence is full of trust. But when people talk about trust, they tend to talk about the more important instances of it, the more meaningful ones. Not that someone driving into you is not a meaningful experience, but if we have a whole, if we have an expectation and a reliance on an entire infrastructure and go through the day unthinkingly, that's one thing. But if we have intimate relationships or professional relationships or are engaging with a police officer in the middle of the night when no one else is around and they have a gun and you don't, those instances of trust are really powerful and really meaningful and really consequential. So most of the time when we talk about trust, we try to find non-trivial examples, even though the most trivial of examples can end up being the most consequential.
We've all heard your trust must be earned. Is trust something we give freely or must it be earned? In my example, I don't know that I earned anybody's trust by asking to have my steak cooked medium and delivered back to me a little bit later, nor did I think the waiter or waitress sense a trust bond with me in that moment. So what does it mean to earn someone's trust?
Well, let's take a step back for a second and recognize that one of the things that makes trust different than, say, love or curiosity is that trust is entirely about looking into the future. Trust is about expecting and relying on the fact, I'm going to channel a philosopher named David Hume, that the future is like the present, that the future is like the past, that the things that happened are going to happen again. The sun is going to rise tomorrow. Human beings are going to still need oxygen. The geometry and engineering behind buildings are going to remain consistent. There is no guarantee that the future is going to be like the past. God, fate, chaos, aliens, the simulation, right? Anything can change in an instant, at least in theory. And so we have to operate in the world as if the future is going to be like the past. In terms of the structural examples that you gave, like the waiter and the example I gave in terms of cars, if we don't accept a base level of trust in the consistency of things, we can't focus. And we know, of course, there are people who experience that and they are burdened by tremendous anxiety. They become agoraphobic. They lose their friends. That, you know, losing that base level of trust is incredibly destructive to people's sense of well-being and identity. So we have to exist in this fundamental expectation that things will remain largely consistent. But then there's the instances in which we really recognize that other people are full agents and free agents and are not necessarily bound to our need. If the server doesn't do their job well, they're going to lose their job. And so they have a self-interest. But if someone says to you, I'm going to pay you back $50, they might have a self-interest in not paying back the $50. And so trust becomes something that you make a judgment about based on your history and their history, and something that they can violate and you can violate. And so I think that as a general rule, we tend to trust people and then ask them to earn their trust after they've violated it. There are certain instances, however, where that default position might be a little dangerous. If you are going on a first date with someone and you really don't know anything about them because you found them on Tinder or wherever, it's best to meet in a public place, to have a coffee instead of invite them into your apartment or get in their car, because you have to see if they're earning your trust. So depending on how precarious the situation is, depending on how vulnerable you are, or in fact, how vulnerable other people are, then you have to earn it. An example I mean by that is, let's say you have a 10-year-old who wants to ride a slightly dangerous amusement ride, or just maybe even just go on their bicycle. You have to trust them enough to make good decisions for themselves, right? You have to trust that the kid is going to not try to jump out of the carnival ride. The kid is not going to take off their helmet. The kid is not going to break the rules that you've established. So sometimes you have to trust for your own vulnerability, but sometimes trusting involves that the other people aren't going to make bad decisions for themselves, and it's about them and their protection and development, and your role as a carer and a concerned person, as opposed to protecting yourself.
Enjoying my conversation with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. We visit monthly in a segment we call Philosophical Currents. Today we're talking about trust, and in just a moment we're going to talk about public trust and institutional trust, but I want to stay in the realm of personal trust for just a moment. You touched on it a moment earlier. What happens in a personal relationship when trust is broken? One party or the other did something in the other person's eyes that broke trust. Maybe seriously, can it be rebuilt? Is it ever rebuilt to the same level? Jack, what happens when trust is broken and then re-earned, as we talked about just a moment ago?
Some of these things are psychological and idiosyncratic, and some people are more forgiving than others, and some people are more trusting than others. And some violations, of course, are more profound than others. There are couples for whom cheating would be an inexcusable violation of trust that could never be overcome. And then there are couples for whom it's not that big of a deal, but it's still maybe as painful or as something that has to be overcome. So another aspect of trust is that it is contextual, and that it's very hard to make generalizations from person to person to person. Now, once that trust is violated, you have to ask yourself not just whether the person is reliable and will learn or grow or atone, but whether you are comfortable taking that risk. Because trust is an attitude about risk, and some people are more risk averse than others, right? Jealousy is a kind of risk aversion. If you are jealous of someone and you look through their diary or their history on the browser or follow them or whatever, it's because you are uncomfortable with the risk. And so you can't trust them because the vulnerability of risk is just, you can't manage it. If you have someone who has broken that trust and you are comfortable with the risk, then you can let them rebuild it. Additionally, it has to do with why people broke the trust or why you were trusting them in the first place. So motivation, we don't want to just explain this in terms of consequences. We want to explain this in terms of motivation as well. If someone broke your trust because they're a recovering alcoholic and they had a bender and did things they promised they wouldn't do, that's a very different scenario than someone knowingly, willingly, uncaringly did those same things. Now, some people are going to react to that and say, I'm going to give a recovering alcoholic a lot more latitude because they're sick and they're trying their best. And some people are going to look at that and say, I'm going to give an alcoholic less trust because you're never fully recovered from being an alcoholic and you're always at that risk. So part of what rebuilding trust reveals is how you feel about the whole story, how you feel about the narrative that you've constructed of your life, of their life, and your relationship, And of course, sometimes you trust but verify, as the expression goes, right? Or trust but protect yourself. So your boss does something suspicious that you don't like and violates your trust, and they say they'll never do it again. You say, okay, you operate through as you do normally, but you update your resume anyway, and you start looking for other jobs anyway, just in case. And I think that there's a conversation to be had as to whether just in case is more trusting or less trusting, right? You can make the argument that doing something just in case is less trusting because you don't have absolute confidence in what they're going to do. But you could also make the argument that just in case is more trusting because you know that the odds of them being trustworthy are less and you're protecting yourself, but you're trusting them to do it anyway in the face of worse odds. So again, it has a lot to do with how we decide to describe the situation and how we interpret the meaning of the situation for our own values and priorities.
All right, Jack, let's turn the page. Let's talk about public trust, institutional trust. I'm talking about things like maybe government or even media, those who listen to me every day here in the state of North Dakota. Is there a difference between trusting institutions than there is trusting an individual? Is that a different type of trust?
It certainly is a different type of trust as philosophers would talk about it, because you're trusting in different things. In personal trust, you are trusting in motivations, you're trusting in habit, you're trusting in character. Institutions, you're trusting in process, you're trusting in checks and balances, you're trusting in oversight. So every time I drive over a bridge, I'm trusting that the system works basically the way it's supposed to. And we, of course, know that there's a whole conversation in our country right now about failing infrastructure. And once that gets to a certain point, and I hope it doesn't.
I think of lead in the water in Flint, Michigan, by the way.
Sure. Right. That's a good example, right? So what, once it gets past a certain point, people are going to be reluctant to cross bridges, just like in Michigan, people are going to be reluctant to drink the water. And part of what's happened in Michigan, though, is that no one has any trust because the trust has already been broken and the government and everyone else says there's lead in the water. You're going to be drinking bottled water for the next 10 years. And Flint, Michigan has no short-term plan to fix that. People have been drinking bottled water for a decade now. So that's an instance of where it's not that the trust broke down, it's that the full institutions broke down. Now, at the same time, the government is in a position right now where it is less trusting for a variety of reasons because of some very strong personalities. We don't trust people, certain people, to be telling the truth. We don't trust people to have the benefit of the American public at heart. We don't trust people. We don't trust that Social Security is going to be there in 10 or 15 years, or at least some of us are very concerned about that. But even so, what has to go wrong for one untrustworthy person to cause chaos in an institution? So let's say Donald Trump decides to prohibit all electricity. I'm trying to pick something uncontroversial. Donald Trump outlaws electricity. Well, in order for that to happen, all of the people who write the executive orders or the laws have to go with it. All the people who enforce it have to go along with it. All of the electric companies have to go along with it. All of the institutions that communicate and punish and regulate and observe all have to go along with it. And that's a lot to go wrong. And part of the reason why we have such distrust in the government right now is a lot of those people are working in tandem with one another and coordinating these things so that a decision or a judgment that might have had no real impact 15 years ago now has a tremendous impact. But I actually want to say something really important here, which is that while we tend to think of the primary relationship in a democracy being the trust in between people and government, the primary trust in a democracy is between citizens. And the government can become untrustworthy and the republic, so to speak, can manage it and deal with it. But once we stop trusting our neighbors, once we stop trusting our fellow citizens, then things really begin to fall apart. And that's what happens. That's what's happening now. And that's how a society really collapses. So I'll just give you an example that I happened to be talking to my students about yesterday, because we're doing this book on fascism. And one of the ways that fascists historically have divided the population, controlled the population, is by pitting rural peoples against urban peoples, by arguing that they're experiences are fundamentally different, and that rural peoples are inherently good and hardworking and full of values, and urban peoples are lazy and untrustworthy and violent and all of that sort of thing. And you create this hostility, which creates two communities that can't unify to fight the authoritarian government. And of course, we see that now. And what we did in as an exercise in my class is we went through the list of things that they say about rural people and compared them to things that they say about rural people, urban people. So just one example, and then I'll tie it in. My students thought that people in rural areas were much more religious and much more conservative. And so I responded and asked, how many of you in small towns have a huge population of people who, women who cannot leave the house without head coverings? And how many people in your small towns have to go to special grocery stores for certain kinds of food? There are profoundly religious and religiously conservative people in cities and huge populations of them. So once you start comparing the two, there are, of course, some day-to-day experiences, differences in those, but mostly the divide between rural and urban is an illusion. And we trust the story that we're told that these people are in opposition, that they have different values, that there's a real America and a fake America, that there's a family people and you know, individualists. But once you break it down, none of that is true. And so the question then becomes, can you look at that empirical evidence and say, I am going to learn to trust people who are quote unquote different than me, even though I haven't in the past. I am going to look at the facts and say, my life and their life, my values and their values, my priorities and their priorities are all basically the same. And despite the fact that I've grown up not trusting them, I am going to trust in the process of trust and practice trusting so that I can eventually trust, right? And so trusting is one of those things that you learn to trust by trusting, and you practice trust by trusting. And when an institution or a person or a car violates your trust, it takes tremendous will to start the process again. And you have to ask yourself, is it worth it? Is it worth the effort? Do I just buy a new car, or do I trust that this is going to get me to my work? Do I stop talking to my neighbors or put a lock on my fence? Or do I trust that my neighbor isn't going to do that thing again? Do I stop believing everything that the government says? Or do I trust that they are trying their hardest? And so I tell myself, I will myself to act as if I'm trusting so that eventually I trust, because once I'm at that moment of trusting, I don't have to think about it anymore. I just trust. I just act based on trust rather than act to cultivate trust.
We're going to have more of our conversation with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. Today, we're talking about trust in our monthly philosophical currents discussion. It's right after this news.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Radisson Hotel Bismarck, offering a Mother's Day brunch buffet in the Terrace Restaurant, Sunday, May 10th from 9:30 to 1. Featuring omelets made to order, Caesar-crusted chicken, an assortment of desserts, and more. More information online at the Radisson of Bismarck Facebook page.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we are exploring today the concept of trust with our good friend, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, distinguished professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota. We visit monthly in the segment we call Philosophical Currents. And Jack, just as we left before the news, I thought of a person whose home I drove by in between Riverton, Wyoming and Casper, Wyoming, in this little town of Moneta, maybe population 4 or 5. Off the road, this person purchased this place and built a large fence around the place. It became to me, it looked like a fort, raised a Confederate flag. And as I drove by, I thought often that person trusts no one. He doesn't trust anybody. Don't we have a moral responsibility to trust?
You know, that's a really interesting question. And as you were telling the story, before you got to the Confederate flag part, I was going to say, maybe it's not that the person doesn't trust anyone. Maybe the person's a nudist and built the fence because they know that they are trusted and they want to protect people's, you know, virgin eyes from seeing this thing. But the Confederate flag obviously creates a different story. Now, what does the Confederate flag tell us? It tells us a couple things. First, it tells us that we should not approach this person. And so, in a certain sense, whoever this person is trusting in the symbol to say, leave me alone. And trusting in the individual interest of people to not knock on their door and try to convince them to be otherwise, right? I mean, we're all used to, we've all had the experience of some religious folks knocking on our door and saying, here is our religion, we want you to convert, right? We don't have the experience, although maybe we should, of knocking on those people's doors and saying, we believe in racial equality and the dignity of all people, we're gonna try to convert you, right? So this person trusts that everyone is going to read the symbols and leave them alone. But the person doesn't trust in, actually, I want to take that back, because what I was going to say was the person doesn't trust in society. The person is afraid of guns, and the person is afraid of
although
of whomever,
probably had a lot of them, right? Is what I thought.
But if the person really didn't trust in society, they wouldn't put the flag up. They wouldn't call attention to themselves, right? People who are really distrusting, people who absolutely believe anarchy is around the corner or we live in the purge, they do everything to not call attention to themselves. And they do everything to hide so that when the purge comes, everyone's focused on other people. Right? What's the old joke that you don't have to run faster than the bear, you just have to run faster than the other people who are running from the bear, right? This person actually trusts in all the institutions enough to say, I disagree with you, and I am going to be intentionally provocative and intentionally belligerent. And so what I would suggest is, while it is easy to read that situation as a person who doesn't trust the world, that what is actually going on is that is a person who really wants a certain kind of attention, creates every symbol to broadcast it, and trusts that other people are going to be emotionally triggered by it. And so that person believes in the predictability of everybody just as much as everybody else does. They pretend it's a lack of trust, but it's actually built entirely on predictable responses. And that itself is a kind of trust.
Jack, can you be a skeptic and still trust? Is skepticism healthy when it comes to trusting the institution or the person?
Skepticism is healthy when it's a good thing to do, and it's unhealthy when it's a bad thing to do. And what I mean by that is, my wife is at work. I could check her location on the phone. I could call a colleague and check to see if she's in her office, right? If I didn't trust her, that would be unhealthy, in part because our relationship is built on trust, but in part because she's never, ever done anything to suggest otherwise. So that would be a mark of me indulging in a certain kind of paranoia and would require me looking at myself. At the same time, if I go, let's say, to the doctor and I'm getting a shot for something, there's nothing unreasonable about asking, hey, will you double check the label, right? Is this the right amount? One thing that they do, I've been told, is that when someone is going to have a limb cut off or a breast removal, they'll magic marker on the leg or the breast, this one, very large, right? Because those mistakes are easy to happen. And even if the process is trustworthy, part of the reason why it's trustworthy is there are these protections and these guide rails. So a certain amount of skepticism is probably unhealthy, and a certain amount of skepticism is probably healthy, and it depends entirely on the context and the question of whether that skepticism is part of the trustworthiness. And that's the example I was using in the doctors, right? The reason why the doctor is trustworthy is because they have all of these mechanisms that are skeptical mechanisms. They ask you your name and your birthday every time you talk to somebody new. They have a bracelet and other things, even though your name is on the door. They write on the leg or whatever, even though it's written on the chart. Part of the reason why it's trustworthy is that skepticism is built into the system. And part of what's wrong right now institutionally is that the American government has skepticism built in it. We've got three different branches that are supposed to run in opposition to one another to create very slow change and to make sure that one branch of the government doesn't have too much power, and that the governmental change is slow enough that if the public wants to react to it, it can do so and possibly curtail the change. But because neither the legislature or the Supreme Court are doing their jobs, they are not being skeptical. They are believing 100% no matter what. One branch, the executive, has too much power. Change is happening incredibly quickly, and the population doesn't have a chance to react. You know, there are midterm elections coming up in November, and the idea of a midterm election is to respond to the behavior of a presidential administration, among other things. But people who are worried about change in our society are thinking, you know, that's 5 months away, and 5 months is an eternity. Right? When has 5 months ever been an eternity in the United States? The civil rights movement took 400 years, right? Women's rights movement took hundreds of years. Our students used to complain about how slow progress is, and now change is radical and lightning fast because we've taken the skepticism out of the system. And because of that, the system is no longer trustworthy.
Yet, many would argue trust is essential for our democracy to continue another 250 years.
Absolutely. And so we're faced with this problem, which is let's assume that the administration is untrustworthy, because there are people who listen right now who think the president, the executive branch, they're wonderful moral role models who are incredibly trustworthy, and everything they do is right and good. Fine, whatever, that's a different conversation. But let's assume that they're not trustworthy. The question, there are a set of questions that result. The first is, how long will it take to repair the mistakes and the harms that we're experiencing? And lots of people say more than a decade. The second is, how long does it take to develop trust in the president and the executive branch? And there are lots of people who suggest that we never really recovered from President Nixon, that the violation that Nixon engaged in destroyed a kind of intimacy between the federal government and Americans that never healed. And what we've been watching is the product of further erosion of trust, because none of our leaders have really been able to make up for it. What making up for it would mean is also a different conversation. So one of the things that a democracy requires is the trust in our neighbors, the trust in our citizens, that as soon as we can fix things, we will all work together to fix them. As soon as the opportunity comes to restore justice, balance, freedom, individuality, whatever, that people are going to act for the common good to fix that as quickly as possible. And the thing that frightens me at least as much as some of the acts of our government is that I don't know that I trust the people as a whole to leap up and say, okay, it's time to fix it. It's time to work together. It's time to heal. It's time to love our neighbor. It's time to recognize that we've been terrified of wrong things. Nobody is eating the cats and dogs, right? We are currently in the have the lowest crime rates in the United States in like 50 years. Americans in general are safer than at any point in certainly my lifetime. And yet we are so distrustful of our neighbors that a kid knocks on the door to sell cookies, or they get lost and are asking for directions, and someone shoots at them through the door, right? We are in panic mode, and we probably ought to have a conversation at some point about why Americans are so unhappy and so disgruntled, because we are a sad, ill, depressed people right now. What scares me in the long term is not necessarily the damage that a government that doesn't have skepticism built in can do, but rather that the people that I would work with to restore the best things about America are too broken, frightened, deceived, self-involved, or poor, ill, in precarious circumstances, unemployed, to be able to help. And having no trust in the fact that things are going to get better is a terrible kind of lack of trust.
Generally speaking, Jack, as we wrap up our conversation today, you've had the wonderful experience, I think, of seeing young people through the years for quite some time. Are young people today more trusting, less trusting? Do you have a feel for that?
That's a really interesting question. And teaching is by far the best part of my job. I love teaching. I love teaching college students. I like that age a lot. I like the process of discovery with them, teaching them new things, having them force me to encounter new things as well. I think that there is a lack of trust between the genders, between male and female, that has been exacerbated in the last decade or so. I think social networks and dating apps have done real damage to male-female relationships in particular. And the students sit segregated much more than they used to when I first got here. Students also distrust the curriculum more. I have a lot more students who come into my classes defensive, thinking that I am trying to change their mind or brainwash them. I can't even get them to do the homework, let alone change their fundamental ideology, right? At the same time, students do have a sense of trust about their community, and they have a sense of trust in themselves and their ability to pick out the falsities from the truth, the dangerous from the safe, the self-destructive from the healthy. And in fact, I think that they may be too trustworthy about that. I think that they think that they are more competent and more skilled and more experienced than they are. And I think because of the worldliness of the internet and the way that a kid in small town North Dakota is going to have a really overlapping common experience with someone in Paris, France, that they've come into my classes feeling like they've seen everything and they know everything. And there's no difference between Grand Forks and Paris or North Dakota or New York. And they don't need to see it. They don't need to experience it. So there are ways in which they're less trusting and they should be more trusting. There are ways in which they trust themselves in, I think, very healthy ways. But there are ways in which they trust themselves in ways that are really self-deceptive and that come from a kind of inexperience, right? You and I know that we thought we knew everything, and then we got married and we realized we knew nothing. And then we thought we knew everything, and then we had kids and we realized that we knew nothing. And they tell me that something happens again when you become grandparents, right? We are old enough to plateau and see our smallness, and our students just have never seen that. Our students, because they have so much access to the world right now, have no experience of their smallness, in part because everybody in the internet is small, but yet that smallness can have global impact. Yeah.
Jack, we'll leave it there. Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein is a distinguished professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota, host of Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, which airs on Prairie Public every second Sunday at 5 o'clock, and our guest monthly on Philosophical Currents, A Moment in the Month. I always look forward to, Jack. Thanks for joining us again here on Main Street.
I love it as well, and I'm super grateful to be here. Yeah.
My man is smooth like Barry, and his voice got bass. A body like Arnold with a Denzel face. He's smart like a doctor with a real good rep. And when he comes home, he's relaxed with pep. He always got to get...
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Hidden Brain. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
This is Bird Note. While Dara Wilson was working at the Smithsonian's National Zoo in D.C., she introduced visitors to the Amazonia exhibit.
You have to talk about every species, all the trees, all the frogs, and all the birds.
She would describe the song of a bird she'd never had the chance to see in the wild, the blue-gray tanager.
Their song, I think it's very beautiful, but like it's a very raspy song. I feel it was like tees and tsk tsk in multiple parts too.
But when Dara moved to Panama to work at the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute, she heard a familiar song, one that she knew by heart already.
I heard that call, and it's like, I know that call. I know that call because I spent so much time teaching about it. I don't know if I cried, but it was kind of a tearjerker moment.
Encountering the blue-gray tanager in its natural habitat inspired Dara to keep learning about birds and to share that knowledge with others, helping people have their own light bulb moments.
As an educator, it's awesome to like guide and foster that journey for people. You never know where it will go.
Dara helps organize Black Birders Week, which celebrates the black birding community and hosts interactive events. Find out how to participate in this year's activities on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Connor Guerin.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 4th. In 1862, Dakota Territory passed a law prohibiting food and drug adulteration. By 1885, a territory-wide board of health had been created, but public health was still lacking. In November of 1918, a female student at the North Dakota Agricultural College became the first North Dakotan to die of the Spanish flu. An estimated 1,300 North Dakotans died in the pandemic. It made clear the state was unprepared for a health emergency. Sanitation was primitive. Cities and towns dumped raw sewage into rivers, allowing diseases to spread downstream. Illnesses like diphtheria and scarlet fever contributed to the state's death rate. Finally, after years of advocacy by medical professionals, the state legislature acted. In 1923, a full-time health officer was hired and a health advisory council was formed. It marked a radical shift in public health. On this date in 1933, the North Dakota Health Officers Association closed its 9th annual conference in Bismarck. Doctors and nurses presented on the state of public health in North Dakota. Attendees learned of 29 deaths from a typhoid epidemic in Chamberlain, South Dakota. The city was cited as a positive example, having taken strong measures that brought the outbreak to an end. The health of children was a major focus of the conference. Childhood malnutrition remained a persistent problem. The number of children needing dental care was reported to be surprisingly large. There was also an increase in childhood tuberculosis and diabetes. The association recommended that children eat more fruits and vegetables to improve their health. Public health nurse Gina Johnson also identified a threat to children's mental health. She warned about radio programs aimed at young listeners, wild stories of hair-raising adventures. She said children were kept at a fever pitch from day to day, focused on whether their favorite characters would escape from villains. She was not alone in her concerns. The controversy over radio thrillers and their effects on children was widely discussed in scientific periodicals. It became one of broadcasting's most pressing issues during radio's golden age. Many of the same questions resurfaced later with television and now with social media. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting art programming here on Prairie Public.
Primaries in Ohio and Indiana could give early signs about whether President Trump's grip on the Republican Party is loosening and how motivated Democratic voters feel in key races. Results may ultimately decide the balance in Congress. Analysis on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Alzheimer's Association Minnesota North Dakota, working with ND Dementia Care Services to offer programs like the Empowered Caregiver Series. Learn more at alz.org/MNND/education-programs.
And that's a wrap for this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, as the Upper Midwest shakes off winter, it's time to get growing. NDSU Extension horticulturalist Don Kinsler shares what every homeowner needs to know about spring lawn care, planting, pruning, and setting up a successful garden season. From soil prep to trees, flowers, and vegetables, Don will have the answers, and that's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.